that the King Messiah will, through prophecy, designate each of the people who will be part of the from all the tribes. So it's a pleasure to be here, and it is really a pleasure to be able to speak to an audience that I can see. I would like to take up this morning the topic of the Garden of Eden. And that's in the very beginning of the Torah, as you know, and I believe it contains, as one would expect, some of the most important concepts for mankind that Torah has to teach man. What I would like to do is carefully analyze the text and take up some key problems, key questions, and through the proper study of the text, and I mean through the way that I've been trained from the scholars of Torah, through the oral law, to carefully analyze the text and see what we can glean, what ideas, important concepts, ways of life, instruction that we can gain from these texts. And I'd like to begin with just a simple, basic question. That question is, as you know, that in the Garden of Eden, where man existed, he committed a sin. And the sin was that he ate from the forbidden tree. And this tree was called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Once he ate from that tree, he gained access to this knowledge. Now here is a question which is pretty clear, pretty obvious. Anyone should raise this question. Maimonides raises a question in the beginning of his famous work, The Guide for the Perplexed. But the question is that this sounds to us as completely illogical, because it seems that God places man in his garden, and he gives man this commandment, and he tells him, do not eat from this tree. Yet, when he eats from this tree, he attains the greatest blessing that man has, which is the ability to differentiate between good and evil. What is the uniqueness of man? The unique mark of man is that he is not simply an instinctual being, but he can differentiate. This is good, this is not good. I will follow this emotion, not that one. Man is crowned with this ability. So how is it possible that the Torah gives us the story where man obtains this wonderful gift through committing a sin? As Maimonides states, this would be like a king telling his subjects, do not commit this crime. And the moment someone does commit the crime, they're instantaneously blessed. Does not make any sense. Okay. This is a question that I think is basically unavoidable, just looking at the text. That's one question. I'd like to just present a few questions, and then we'll try to take a look at the text carefully and see how we can resolve it. My second question, and this is not my question, it's a question which has been raised by the Talmudic scholars. Bible critics have noticed that, of course, their solutions are different than ours. The question is, why are there two accounts of Genesis? The account that you have in the beginning, and especially that part that relates to man, which is on the sixth day of creation, which is found in Genesis 1 from 24 on, okay, that chapter, till the end of Genesis 1. And there you have one account of man. Then you have, all of a sudden, in Genesis 2:4, as you know, I mean, the breakdown of these chapters and verses are not according to Torah scholars. It was done by Christian scholars, and they are not really in line many times with the logical order. We will discuss one of those a little further. But at any rate, we use them for reference. So in Genesis 2:4, you have a new beginning, sort of, a whole new tale, a whole new account of what took place. And here it starts off, for instance, in 2:7. And God created man, dust from the earth, and he blew into his nostrils the breath of life, and man was a living creature. Okay, I don't know what your translation is. I'm just doing it from my head, but it should be pretty close to that. So in 2:7, it sounds as if man didn't exist yet. As a matter of fact, there's a reversal in order if you take a look. Because if you take a look at 2:5, it says, and all the grasses of the field before they were in the land, and all the grass of the field before it sprouted forth. And really, it states why. It says, because God hadn't reigned on the land, and man was not present, was not there to work the land. So it would seem that the grasses of the field came after Adam. Whereas in the first account, it's reversed. It's on the third day. Okay? We will explain that as well. The second account seems to start off as if there was no record of the first account. Why do we have these two accounts? That's my second question. And what is the meaning of why does there have to be two accounts? And if we resolve the problem properly, if we answer the question properly, the way we like to answer a question in Talmudic thinking is that the answer must be clear, must speak for itself, and must not simply to show that these two accounts are not in contradiction, but to explain why there had to be two accounts. There's a reason why there are two accounts. And if you understand the concepts in the Torah, you'll see that it could not have been written in any other way. Okay. There is one other point that I would mention in my first three questions. And that is the rabbis of the Talmud have already given us an allusion to the answer to this problem. And they've stated that if you take a look, you'll notice that God's name is different in the first account than in the second account. In the first account, the name is Elohim. I'm not pronouncing it properly because I'm not permitted to use the term unless there is some valid reason for it. Elohim, that's one term which is used to signify God. That term means multi-powerful. That's why it's in the plural. Multi-powerful. In the second account, there is another name attached to it, and that's Adoshem. Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. That's what is commonly referred to as the J. We don't have a J in Hebrew, but that's what they refer to as a J. So another name of God is added to the first name. And that is, for instance, in Genesis 2:4. B'yom asos Hashem Elokim Eretz Yisrael. On the day that God Almighty, I'm using the word God, but it's the J word, Hashem Elokim Eretz, when God made Eretz Yisrael. So over here, it's not in the second account, the first name of God is there too. But there is another name that is super added to it. And that is the name of, some refer to it as Tetragrammaton. It's the name that is not to be pronounced, according to the Torah, is not permitted to be pronounced. The reason is because the name Elohim, which means multi-powerful, it's okay for a person to enunciate because he's not really saying anything about God himself. Whereas the name, the four-lettered name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that name contains in it an idea about God's existence himself. And because of that, we are not permitted to utter that name except on rare occasions to indicate that man does not really have and cannot really have a knowledge of God himself. Yet, under certain circumstances, we are permitted to enunciate it, for instance, in the Holy Temple, to indicate that man is obligated to search and to pursue his quest for his knowledge of God insofar as he is capable. So on the one hand, he is to pursue the knowledge of God. On the other hand, he's supposed to know that he really can never obtain such a knowledge. That's why that name is the one that's not permitted to be enunciated, only under rare occasions. Whereas the name of Elohim means multi-powerful. And that is fine because you're just referring to the way God affects the universe. But the rabbis tell us that there's another signification in these two names. And the one name Elohim means God as absolute judge. Okay? It's called the attribute of law, of justice. That's whenever you see the name Elohim. Whenever you see the name Adoshem, the ineffable name, that really always characterizes God's attribute of kindness, of compassion and mercy. Okay. Now, the rabbis tell us that in the Torah, whenever you see those names, that's always the way it works. The reason why you have the change in the name is because they're two attributes of God. Now, I want to make this clear, that the fundamental concept of Torah monotheism is that God has no components. He is not constructed like any of his creation, like we are. We have different parts to us. We have a psyche. We have a body. We have a mind. We have emotions. God is not to be equated to any of his creation. As the prophet says, "To whom shall you compare me?" saith the Holy One. Okay. So when we say that God, when we say God has attributes, we do not mean he has attributes like we have attributes. What then do we mean when we say this? When we say that God has the attribute of mercy, and then we say that God has the attribute of justice. What exactly does that mean? We know he doesn't really have components in his makeup. He is echad, he is singular. He is not a composite. Okay, so what do we mean when we say that God has the attribute of mercy and the attribute of justice? And it would seem that the two are contradictory. Why? Because if you go before a judge, and the judge is merciful, it would seem he is not being strictly just. Because that means, according to justice, the judge would say, well, you deserve such and such a sentence. But now I'm going to be merciful. So that means his mercy is overriding his justice. He can't be both merciful and just at the same time. It's a contradiction in terms. So again, the question is, what exactly do we mean when we say that God has these two attributes? And the rabbis of the Talmud tell us that the secret of these two accounts lies precisely in understanding the fact that the first account was the creation in terms of God as the absolute just the God creating the universe totally with justice, and the second account is God creating the universe through mercy. Two different accounts. The rabbis say that in order to understand the two accounts, that's the key. What exactly do they mean by that? We don't even understand what the concepts are, attributes of mercy and attributes of justice. What does that mean? So basically, those are my three questions. Question one is, as I mentioned before, how is it possible that God should give man a prohibition, and through violation of that prohibition, he's going to attain the greatest thing that man has, the knowledge of good and evil? My second question is, why are there two accounts? And as a component of that question, I mentioned that the rabbis say the secret to unraveling why there are two accounts lies in the fact that the name of God is different in the first account than in the second account. And the first account is God as the source of all justice, and the second account is God of mercy. What do we mean by that, and how does that explain the two accounts? Okay. Now, let us take a close look at the Bible itself, at the Torah itself, and try to unravel, and so far as we can, through careful analysis of the text, what exactly took place in the Garden of Eden. Now, there are parts, there are components here. Some components I am not going to touch. We have a principle in the study of Talmud. It's a logical principle, and that is that a person many times is attracted to certain areas of knowledge. But the way to pursue knowledge is not always to follow your curiosity. Your curiosity can set up questions, but when you're pursuing knowledge, you have to go to the area where the mind can start making a breakthrough. So I'm not going to go through many of the areas. For instance, the rivers, which is a question, or even the snake. I'm not going to discuss that area. Those are separate components. What I want to just do is take the major outline of the story of the Garden of Eden, analyze it, and let us see what we can derive from it. Let us start with the text in Genesis 2:15. Okay. 2:15. But let me just mention first that you should keep your eyes open to 2:7 as well, where it says, that God Almighty formed man dust from the earth, and he blew into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living creature. Now this term over here that is used, living creature, is nefesh chaya. Now nefesh chaya in Hebrew, if you take a look back at the term where it was used in the beginning of Genesis, it's a very interesting term because it is used for the animal kingdom. Nefesh chaya. When God said that the earth should bring forth life, he used the term nefesh chaya. Nefesh chaya is indicative of the instinctual life. That's the term that it's used, that's the way it's used before. Now if you take a look at the first account of man, you'll see that God says, Genesis 1:26, and God said, let us make man in our form, in our likeness. And 27, and God created man in his likeness, in the likeness of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So over here, what do we mean by the likeness of God? And this, all the scholars agree, it's referring to the human mind. The unique ability that man has to penetrate beyond the physical, to be in tune with the world of ideas, that his sense of reality is not based upon his physical senses, but upon his mind. And this is the unique aspect of man. So in Genesis, in the first account, the emphasis is on man as a supreme being in the sense that he has this, he partakes of godliness. He partakes of the supreme being himself. He has something in common. He can link up with God's knowledge. That is the first account. In the second account, strangely enough, the slant, the accent, is not on that part of man, but it's on the instinctual part of man, where it says man becomes a nefesh chaya. Okay, it's an animalistic, his animalistic traits. That's an interesting thing. It's something we should keep in the back of our mind as we proceed. But now let's go back to the actual account. And for that, we return to 2:15. And God took man and he placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. And God commanded man, and he said to him, you can eat from all the trees of the garden, but from the tree of knowledge and good of evil, you should not eat from it, because on the day that you eat from it, you will surely die. Now, it's interesting. We know that man did eat from it a few verses later, and he did not die. This is something we have to understand as well. Seems like an open contradiction between a few verses. Okay? But let's proceed. Then it says, and God said, it is not good for man that he should be alone. I will make him a helpmate. Create for him a helpmate. Now, this was the creation of Eve. All right? Now, take a look at these verses. The first thing we should ask is, wasn't Eve forbidden as well as Adam to eat from the tree of knowledge? Isn't that correct? Should not have God have created Eve first? Then he would have Adam and Eve. Then he would instruct them both not to eat from the tree. And then the rest of the account of the story would take place. That would seem to be the logical order. But here you have a strange sequence of verses. Okay? First, God creates man. Okay? And it emphasizes, as a matter of fact, his instinctual nature. Then it shows you that man is an intelligent creature as well. The first time we really know that he's intelligent is in verse 16, where it says, God commanded man. The brute creation does not tolerate a commandment. Commandment dictates, demands intelligence. Here we see man as intelligent as well. Then, after God instructs man, tells him what's going to happen to him if he does not abide by God's law, then God suddenly says it's not good for man to be alone. What's the connection here? Then take a look. The next verse is equally astounding. We should have gone from 18, the natural order should not have been 19. 19 has nothing to do with this. It should have gone to 21. Okay? Then it should have said God says that he will create a helpmate. How did God do it? As you know, verse 21, that Adam fell asleep and he took a part of Adam, And through that, he created Eve and brought her to Adam. So you have this interruption after verse 18 where God says that it's not good for man to be alone. Then you have 19 and 20. What does 19 and 20 say? That God created the animals and brought them before Adam. And Adam called them names, gave names to them. And whatever name Adam gave them, that was its name. Okay? Then it continues, and Adam called names to all the creatures that he encountered, and he didn't find a helpmate. Okay? And then it comes back to God creating Eve. What is the sequence? What is the logical sequence of these verses? There is a specific order that we're encountering here. Okay? It's a funny thing, but this order actually continues. This part with the names, verse 19 and 20, is continued, strangely enough, in 3:20. If you take a look at 3:20, after the whole story of the Garden of Eden, then you come back to 3:20, and Adam called the name of his wife Eve, because she was the mother of all living. So, again, there's sort of like an interruption over there, too. You have first him calling the names, and then you have this story, and then it comes back to him calling names again when he calls his wife Eve. What kind of a continuity is that? I would like to start unraveling the mystery of the two accounts by understanding just this part of the text. The continuity of the text right here, and then we'll go a little further into the actual sin and how it and how that affected man. We see one thing. If you take a look at 19 and 20, 19 itself, what is the Torah really describing here? Torah is describing one thing, that Adam, man, was an intellectual creature. Because it says that God brought all the animals before man. Why did God bring these animals before man? And the Torah tells us, in order that he should call them names. And it states, whenever Adam called them a name, that was its name. Well, what do you mean that was its name? Of course, he can make up any name he wants. That's going to be the name. There's nobody else around to contradict him. What is the Torah teaching us here? The Torah doesn't mean names. What the Torah means is classification. Understanding. It means that Adam was involved in studying nature. He was studying God's universe. And God wanted him to study his universe because he brought the animals before him. And it states that his intelligence was so accurate that when he studied each animal, its own method of survival, the parts and structures of its body, and he would define exactly why one animal is differentiated from another, how its survival techniques differ, what is the whole system, the ecological system, when he would think and give a definition, that was the correct definition. God himself attests to the fact that his mind was so accurate, so refined, that he was able to precisely understand each creature, its nature, and why and how it differs from another creature. This was man at his finest. This was man acting in the way that God intended and wanted him to act. And this is not just a story of the past. This is important for us. Because people say, what is the purpose of human existence? Why are we living? What's the purpose of our life? And many people come up with different answers. Some say, well, it's to enjoy life, pleasure. Others say, it's to be kind to others. Nice answers. But what does the Torah say? The Torah says the reason why God created man was for one purpose and one purpose alone. And that is to appreciate the knowledge of God. To appreciate God's knowledge. And this wasn't just Adam, it's for us. That means that that's the ultimate objective. No matter what a person does in life, anything he will do will only be a means towards one thing. Knowledge. How much knowledge did this person gain in his lifetime? That's the sum value. Kindness towards others is part and parcel of the personality and the character that is recipient of knowledge. Because in order to have knowledge, you must have a certain kind of character. The Torah is very, very big on that. That knowledge is not just IQ. And people make a big mistake. I know they're having experiments where they're crossing, trying to create superior people. It's nonsense. There are many people with very high IQs, and they accomplish absolutely zero in their lives. And there are people with not such high IQs, but they have penetrated the mysteries of life, of the creation. And character, the character of an individual, plays a greater role, even, than the IQ and the intelligence alone. The purpose of man is, the ultimate objective is, to be able to appreciate God's wisdom. And I could prove it very simply. When you say be kind to someone, kindness has to have an objective. What's the purpose? What are you being kind to for what? So that he can enjoy his physical pleasures? Well, if that's what you think life is, then that's it. But kindness can only be a means. And what do we do when, in the ultimate time, when God will give us a situation where you won't have to be kind to everyone because everyone will be fortunate? Then that will be the end of your life. There will be no purpose in your existence. So there must be an ultimate purpose in life. And the Torah tells us that this is the ultimate objective. It started with Adam, and it's true today. Today, of course, we have another means that God saw fit to give to us, and that is the Torah itself, knowledge of Torah. So through knowledge of Torah, and through knowledge of the universe as well, the prophets talk about the heavens and the beauty of God's creation, and the Torah always maintains that both are important. Knowledge of Torah has a certain priority because it teaches man how to live. It must be encountered first, but after that, that's not the end. Even knowledge of the entire universe, just like Adam did, is the purpose of our existence. So here we have man as a being of knowledge. He's living on the highest level, and this was definitely so even before the animals were brought to him. It's interesting, because before they were brought to him, he was also analyzing and thinking when he was in the garden. He was studying the garden. He was studying anything that came into the grasp of his range of knowledge, of his mind. And he was analyzing and thinking. Now, what happens when God saw that God told him, gave him one instruction? What did he say to him? He said, you can eat from all the trees of the garden, but there's one tree that you cannot eat from, and that is this specific tree. What was special about this tree? You know what the rabbis of the Talmud say this tree was? Arguments. Some say it was wheat. Some say it was fig. Some say it was an esrog. What are they telling us, the rabbis? It's not a question of really which tree it was. It was an ordinary tree. There was nothing special about it. It's a tree that we have today. Nothing unusual about it. But why did God tell man that he can't eat from it? For one reason. God told man the following. You are created. Your ultimate objective is to use all your energy to pursue the knowledge that I have set before you. Set before you a world, a universe, an endless quest. You could be involved endlessly in the quest of knowledge. And this is your life. But, insofar as your instinctual life, you have to exercise a certain control. What is that control? The control is you cannot give way to your fantasy. When does a person have fantasy? When a person cannot have something. Something a person has, very quickly, the fantasy is overcome. We know how we fantasize about things that we think we're going to get, the next house or the next car, and never quite gives us that enjoyment that we expected from it. As soon as we use it, it becomes mundane very quickly. But that which we can't have, that which we don't have, or many times that which somebody else does have, arouses in us a tremendous fantasy. Energy becomes directed towards that. God told man, you are to use your energy for study and knowledge, but you also have to exercise a certain control over your instinctual life, and you cannot give way to your fantasy and your imagination. And that was the prohibition of the tree. Wasn't anything special about the tree. It was an ordinary tree, but it wasn't ordinary to Adam. Why? Because he could not partake of it. So man had to exercise, he had just one commandment. That commandment had everything in it, because that commandment really hits at the root of man's nature. To be able to overcome his fantasy and direct his emotions in line with reality. Then God said as follows. God says it is not good for man to be alone. What does it mean, it's not good for man to be alone? Originally, apparently, he was supposed to be alone. This seems like an afterthought. Why didn't God immediately create Eve? The answer is, God works with man according to the way he acts and according to his developmental process. As man develops, God works with him. Okay? And as man was developing, God saw that he cannot really sublimate all this energy into thinking. A certain part of it is not satisfied. And that part turned into loneliness. That energy that wasn't satisfied through thinking was experienced in him as feeling a certain loneliness and a certain emptiness. He was unable to do anything with that excessive energy. That's when God says, it is not good for man to be alone. I created a being that is intellectual and he's instinctual, but he's capable of using all that energy in thought. Tremendous sublimation. But he really cannot do it completely. There's a part of him that is not going to be satisfied. That's when God decided that Eve must be created. And take a look. The next two verses. Next two verses say that God actually took man from whatever intellectual involvement he was involved with before. He took him and he distracted him, and he told him, he brought the animals before him, and he got his mind involved in what? In the study of the animal kingdom. And the rabbis tell us that when Adam was studying the animal kingdom, and he studied the sexual part of the animal kingdom, the processes of procreation, he started to reflect about himself. And he started to think, well, what about me? And he, at first he thought that, at first he thought, well, perhaps I am like these animals. But then he came to a realization that whatever his mate would be, it would not be similar to the case of the animals. Because he noticed that the animals instinctually mate. But with him, something more would be necessary. Because he didn't just have the instinct, but he had a psyche as well, a complex psyche. Because it was a combination of instinct and knowledge. And this placed him in a totally different frame of mind. So when Adam analyzed the way the animals are, their nature, and their procreation, he saw that he cannot partake of this kind of mating process. And that is explained clearly in verse 20. And Adam called names to all the animals and to the birds of the heaven and all the wildlife of the field. And what does it say? But to Adam, he didn't find anyone that could be a helpmate to him. What does it mean? He came to that realization that he too requires a mate, but not like the mating that he's observing in the animal kingdom. Then God came in and he made Adam fall asleep and he created Eve. And then it states very interestingly that what did Adam say? Adam said in verse 23, Adam said, Zos hapam, this time, this is unique, this is something special. A bone from my bones and flesh from my flesh. To this shall be called woman, because from man this was taken. Here the Torah is teaching us a very interesting principle. And it's a principle that was true in the time of Adam, and it's true today. What did Adam need? It's an amazing phenomena. Adam could not just have Eve. Wouldn't satisfy him, because he was a psychological being. And due to that fact, he had to be able to relate to her in a special way. What was that special way? He could only love her if she were an extension of him. You see, originally, man, the psychic energy that a person has, originally is tied to the self. And it happens to be true today as well. Psychologists show us that the earliest stages of man, the earliest stages of childhood, the first love is what psychologists call a narcissistic love. It's a love tied with the self. As a matter of fact, the child doesn't even know the boundary between the self and between the mother or father or parent. Then the child learns that there is a difference. There's an external and there is something external to me. But at first, that first stage is what psychologists call the narcissistic stage. And it's amazing how the Torah over here really points precisely to that concept. That Eve was taken from Adam. And Adam said, a bone from my bones, flesh from my flesh. Then he could psychologically enjoy the relationship. That was a necessity, because man by nature Once man is created, man by nature has his energies are wrapped up in the self to a tremendous degree. We may not want to admit this, but the fact is that is the way a human being is. And Adam, in order to be able to appreciate Eve, had to have that bridge between the self. There's a bridge between the self and someone external to him. You know, in halacha, we have an interesting law, and that is a person cannot be on the Sanhedrin unless they have children. Why is it so? A person can be the greatest scholar and not have children. We've had that. But what it means is that the child is a psychological bridge. It breaks the person's narcissism, and it's a bridge. This is someone that's external to me, and yet they're just like me. That's a bridge to the rest of mankind. So the Torah is very psychologically oriented. And over here in Genesis, the Torah is describing the fact that Adam would not have been able to really appreciate Eve if he didn't feel that it was a component of him. That it was tied to his first idea of love, which was directed strictly towards the self. So then you have the two of them. But I want you to understand this. This is extremely important. That this does not mean in any way that Eve was an inferior person. Does not mean that in any way. As a matter of fact, in the first account, where it speaks about the highest element of man, it says that God created man in his image, in his likeness. Male and female created he them. Okay? This is just the processes that were necessary in order to have a situation where there will be a mutual love between the two. It would seem, insofar as Eve was concerned, that important to her was the fact that Adam had this unique appreciation of her. And we have this in the Talmud. It states that a Talmud looks at man and wife as two psychologically as being different, having different components. The Talmud says that a husband must respect his wife more than himself. To show respect to his wife more than he does to himself. And it says that a wife must treat her husband, must make him feel that he is a great person. So man is more ego-oriented, and the Talmud recognizes this. But a woman is more realistic, but she wants that the feeling of appreciation, that she is appreciated for what she is. And these two different types and models are expressions of man and woman. Now, when I say expression of man and woman, I don't mean that every man and every woman is that way. I mean that there is manness with a capital M and womanness with a capital woman. But we all partake, depending on the person, of different degrees of each. But this is the absolute in terms of the model. Okay. So then we have that God created Eve and that's the order of these verses. So here up to this point you have man at first existed totally intellectual. Didn't work. Man wasn't capable of that. He had to have some other kind of satisfaction, an emotional satisfaction. He needed a helpmate. Then God wanted man, before he had Eve, he wanted man to appreciate Eve. How did he do this? He had man study the animal kingdom. Then he started to think about what would he need. And then when Eve came on the scene, he was fully able to appreciate it. Because man is an intelligent creature, and you can't just give man something. It has to be in line with his nature. Now we start with the beginning of the famous story of the Garden of Eden. And really, here is where there's a mistake. Truth of the matter is that verse 25 in chapter 2 should not be, that should be 3:1. That's really where it should begin. Now let's take a look at the order of these verses. Now it states that man, both of them, the man and the woman, were naked and they were not ashamed. Okay. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? What would you say? Yes, it is a good thing. It is a good thing. And we'll explain why it's good. That really is the introduction to this chapter. Now let's take a look. I'm not going to go into what the snake represents. That's not part of this. I just want to get into the main account. Now it says that we jump to 3:6. It says the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was something which was appealing, I mean, enticing, drawing to the eyes. And it was captivating. And here's a word in Hebrew, I don't know, I think a translation says, the nechmor eitz lahaskil, that the tree was desirous for knowledge. Is that what it has? Yeah. Knowledge is the wrong word here. Lahaskil, the word sechel, comes from soch. Soch means to see, to view. It means like to perceive something new. Okay? And Tirgum Onkelos, who, as you know, was a proselyte, he says, istakala means to view. It means a new dimension. There's some kind of a new scene that man will appreciate once he partakes of this tree. And over here, it doesn't matter at this point whether the woman did it or the man did it, it's insignificant. Man sinned in the same way as woman did. I'm not going to go into the detail of why she took it first and he took it second. That's a separate point. But they both sinned based upon the same elements. What were the elements? That suddenly their fantasy started to arouse in them with regard to this tree all these feelings that it's desirous. The way the Torah describes it, I mean, the Hebrew really, tavahu le'nayim, it describes it in a way like it's everything you'd ever want to imagine. That's basically what the pasuk says, okay? So man and woman are overcome by this desire, and instead of realizing that this is just fantasy, they give way to the fantasy and they indulge themselves. Okay? And then the Torah says that what happens to them is in the next verse. Two things happen. Their eyes are opened and they knew that they were naked. Two things. What is the first thing? The first thing is that it was true. A new dimension was gained for them the moment they ate from that tree. What was that new dimension? The instinctual. Then they were in the grips of instinctual life. Lust. They really felt it. Until this point, they didn't. Let me give you, and this is important, what is the difference between man before the sin and after the sin? Everybody knows, well, he sinned. Well, what happened to him? Something bad. What is precise? What is the difference? What kind of inventory? Something we can, is it intelligible? Can we understand it? The rabbis give us a parable. The rabbis say as follows, that man, before he sinned, Adam, before he sinned, he was only sexually aroused when he actually saw Eve. He didn't see her, he wasn't sexually aroused. After he sinned, the rabbis are very frank. Sex is something which the rabbis talk about openly. Our society was very repressed about it. That's a result of Christianity, basically. But the rabbis say that insofar as his sexual orientation, there was a change. Before, when he saw her, he was aroused. Afterwards, roeh o eino roeh, he's misava. What does that mean? He didn't have to see her. What it means is as follows. That originally man was capable of sin. Because otherwise, how could he have sinned if he wasn't capable of sin before? So he must have been capable before. So if he's capable before, so what's in before and after? If he wasn't capable, how did he sin? The answer is as follows. Before, his energy mainly went into the intellectual sphere. That means that when Adam was simply walking around the garden, automatically his energy went into thought. Okay? But then, if he saw something that would distract him, his energy would be drawn into the instinctual. All right? Now, after he sinned, what happened was there was a change in the flow of energy, which means that the energy flows now towards the instinctual. If you want to use it towards the higher form, you have to draw it away from the instinctual. We all know that that's true, okay? In other words, when you get up in the morning, the first thing you're not going to think about, I got to pursue this idea in Torah, unless you're really an unusual person. But most people do not think about that. They start thinking about if it's their day off, their enjoyments and their pleasures. Then someone starts talking about an idea, Torah, they get drawn in, they can be drawn in for hours. And then they say, hey, I had a great time, this is unbelievable. I had a better time than I did watching television last night. But until he's drawn in, it's hard. He has to pull himself, there's the pull. The tug is towards the instinctual. But if he overcomes that tug, if he pulls himself away, then he can be drawn into the higher sphere. That's the way man is now. Originally, before he sinned, he automatically, the energy was directed towards the higher sphere. But then what happened was that if something would attract him, he could be drawn away. That's how the tree drew him away. But once he ate from that tree, he became overpowered with the instinctual, and then he was not the same anymore. His attachment between the self and the instinctual was changed forever. That was the change. Now, what happened? What happened over here was an amazing thing. Two results. One was that his eyes were open. That means his whole instinctual life had a tremendously different related, different power over him. That's one. But then also, when that happened, it says, and they knew that they were naked. What is the Torah describing? What does it mean when it says they were naked? What does that mean, that a person knows that they're naked? We know that that's true. A person feels a certain shame. Where does that shame come from? The shame comes from another component of the human mind, what we commonly call conscience, what psychologists call the superego. That's a component of the mind. So here we see that God was really gracious to man. Why? Because man, the moment he sinned and he was overpowered by the instinctual, he would be dead. He would have to die because he could never exist anymore. Once the instinctual overpowered him, then he'd be lost, because he was created to be a being that is in the higher sphere, appreciating the wisdom and knowledge of God. But now he's overpowered by the instinctual. So what is going to happen to him? He would surely have died. Except one thing, that God, through his graciousness, gave man a different component of his mind, conscience. Conscience is something which actually counterbalances the forces of the instinctual. A lot of times people want to do things that are bad, but what do they say? Can't face myself. How could I do this? Stops them. What is it? Is it intellect that stops them? No. It's conscience. Is conscience the real guide according to Torah? No. Absolutely not. Conscience is not the guide. Conscience is a component which was introduced and given to man in order to counterbalance the tremendous force of instinct. But the guide is the mind, the intelligence, knowledge. That remains the guide. The only thing is, if God had not, through his mercy, given man the element of conscience, if he wouldn't have known that he was naked, he wouldn't have had a sense of shame, he would have been lost, he would have died. That would have been the end of man. So here in the second account, the Torah teaches us actually how the human mind came into existence, the components of the human mind. And it shows us that the way God created man was totally different than the way he created the animal kingdom. That's why you have two accounts, why you must have two accounts. If there were only one account, it would mean that God relates to all of the creation in the same way. Inanimate, animate, including man. That's not true. The way God relates to man is totally different than he relates to the rest of the creation. The first account is the account of the God of justice. What does that mean? That means how God intended the world to be in the perfect state. In the perfect state, what was man supposed to be? A Tzelem Elohim. A reflection, in a sense, of the divine, of the divine being in a small way. He reflected the divine being in a small way, because he could appreciate the knowledge of God. Whatever he called the name, that was the name. That was the original intent of God. That's the first chapter, the first account. But if it would have remained in that account, man would not have survived. Because man, what he did was he gave way to his emotions. When he gave way to his emotions, he was caught up. They had a grasp on him. We believe that exists today also. We say that when a person does a sin, it's not just the fact that he did this. It's not a misdemeanor. God isn't like a strict teacher in the sky that's counting who does a sin, who does something, the righteous deed. That's a childish idea. What it means when a person does a sin, he's giving way. He is turning towards the instinctual. It has a stronger grasp on him. Unless he repents and pulls himself away, his whole self has changed. The person, the personality has changed. That's what happened to Adam. And when that happened to Adam, God, instead of destroying him at that point, which would have been the God of justice, would have said, that's it. I gave you a chance. You sinned. Now you're not a creature anymore. This is not the creature I intended to create. And the moment something exists that God didn't intend to exist, it has to cease to exist, because we only exist because of his will. But God, through his mercy, made a change. He gave man another chance. He gave him another component. He placed a component in his psyche, the component of conscience, to counterbalance the instinctual life, so that man has a chance again. What does it mean when we say God is the attribute of mercy? It doesn't mean God himself has two attributes. Heaven forbid such a notion. That's contrary to our monotheistic idea. What it means is that God acts insofar as the creation differently than insofar as man. Insofar as the creation, he is the perfect God. Whatever he creates, that's the way it's supposed to be. The heavens are the same way, precisely the way God ordained them to be. That's the way they are, and that's the way they'll be till the end of time. But with man, there's a unique relationship. When man falters, and when man isn't living up to that perfect plan, God steps in, and he saves him. That's what it means by mercy. Mercy does not mean something in God, an extra thing. It means the way God acts. God acts towards man, not only because of his perfect plan, but because of man's imperfect action. That's what it means by mercy. So here we see an account in Genesis how God works along with man in creating himself. Actually, the account of Genesis is teaching us an amazing thing, and that is that God not only gave man knowledge, but he worked together with him in creating his own personality. First he wanted to see, can you exist with just these two components, the instinctual and the intellectual? Can you exist? He gave him Eve. That's satisfied one thing. But then, even after that, he wasn't able to succeed. And when he failed, God had to introduce something new into his makeup, something that changed him forever, and that was the conscience. Through that, man was able to survive. What does it mean, the tree of good? Let me just take one more verse. It's interesting. Now take a look at verse 8, how beautifully it follows. And this is one of the most anthropomorphic verses in the Torah. Bible critics many times use this to mention that the Torah primitive idea of God. Heaven forbid the idea. And it says, and they heard the voice of God, Elohim, walking in the garden. L'ruach hayom. L'ruach hayom over here means in the wind of the day. There are several interpretations. In the wind of the day, it means it was a kind of a vision, because whenever the prophets on a vision, it says they saw the sa'ara, the wind, or the cyclone. So he had this vision. But why did he have this vision? Why was the vision anthropomorphic? The reason is because he was reduced from his stature. The Torah, this is not accidental that the Torah describes this in an anthropomorphic way. He heard the voice of God walking in the garden, L'ruach Hayom. What does it mean? It means to say that once he had this guilt and this conscience, he perceived God in a conscience way. That's what the verse is describing. How did he perceive God? He heard the voice walking through the garden. He felt his guilt, and he hid. The Torah is telling us that this new stage that he had reached through violating the commandment of God didn't raise him to a higher level, placed him in a different frame of reference insofar as God is concerned. Now he looks at God differently. God is a source of his conscience and his guilt, you see, because of the new dimension that was added to him. That's what it states immediately after verse 7, you have verse 8, because the most important idea in Torah is what one's idea of God is. Everything revolves around that one idea. If one accepts God or denies God, whatever a person does in his life, metaphysically, all is based upon one thing. What is his idea of God? If he denies God, for instance, then he'll believe then life is just physical pleasures. That's going to be his objective. If he believes in a God that is simply a God of punishment and reward, he's going to try to just spend his entire life pursuing punishment and reward. If he believes God is the source of all knowledge and wisdom and that's the ultimate reality, that's what he's going to spend his life doing. So the idea of God is the most important idea in a person's life. And the Torah shows you that the moment he sinned, what happened? This most important idea became distorted. He couldn't perceive God like he did before. Before, he was in direct perception of God. He didn't have to look at him through any medium of emotions. But after this, man was reduced to a different kind of a level. Now, we understand what it means when we say that going back to our questions. By the way, you see, after that's why the continuity is that after the sin in 3:20, it says, and Adam called the name of his wife Eve. What does that mean? That means after this whole incident, and after he had this new quality, new dimension added to his personality and his character, then he was able to go back again to wisdom. And he started to define He called Eve under it. He gave her a different definition, a different aspect to her nature, that she is the first mother. He was defining motherhood and all the psychological ramifications of motherhood. So he went back to analysis and understanding and investigation after this. What the Torah is trying to show you is that God saved him through his intervention and permitted him once again to be involved in that which is really important, the pursuit of knowledge. Okay, now let's just go back over our questions just to make sure we answer them properly. First question was, how could the Torah say that through this violation, man obtained the greatest gift, which is knowledge of good and evil? What's the answer? The answer is, he didn't obtain the knowledge of good and evil through the tree. What it means is, he was forced into the realm of good and evil. Because before that time, there was no necessity for the knowledge of good and evil. Why should a person have to understand what is good and what is evil if he naturally does good? Does an animal have to have a dictionary to tell him what to do? Do you have to have any kind of book to tell him how to live? No. The answer is because he naturally does what is good. Man originally was the same way. Man naturally did that which was within his nature, to pursue knowledge. There was no necessity to study whether this is good or that is not good. He did it. But once he was reduced and the instincts overpowered him, then he was in trouble, then he was caught. One side of him draws him in this direction. The other side draws him in the other direction. Then he needs the knowledge of good and evil. So man's knowledge of good and evil was not really a good for him. It's a science that we would be better off without it. But unfortunately, because of our nature, because of our corrupt nature, because of our instinctual life, we must involve ourselves in the pursuit of what is good and evil because we don't naturally do what is good. So what the Torah is describing here is not a new dimension in terms of intellectual knowledge. Rashi points this out, and the scholars of the Talmudic scholars point to that he knew what was good and what was not good intellectually, but he didn't have to be concerned with the pursuit of what is good and what is not good because there was no need for it. Once he ate from the tree, then it was a necessity for him to constantly be aware of what is good and what is not good in order to direct his life. So, what is good and what is evil, basically? What is good and what is evil existed before the tree. Good and evil is very simple. Good is man living the proper way, directing all his energies towards the highest sphere, appreciation of God's knowledge and God's endless wisdom. That was the good. Evil is giving way to the instinctual life. Okay, but before eating from the tree, he didn't have to be involved in the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, I have to go. All right, now why there are two accounts? I think we explained why you have a necessity for two accounts, and why the emphasis in the first account is on the higher part of man. The emphasis in the second account is on the instinctual, because the second account is really dealing with how man coped with the instinctual. That's the whole story. That's why I call them nefesh chaya, because this account is going to tell us about that aspect of his personality that was responsible for formulating his nature. Now, okay, and the difference between the midas hadin and midas harachamim, the two attributes of God, is as we have explained, not in terms of God himself, but in terms of the cause of God's actions. Okay.